This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. The Macomb County executive says he's in favor of regional mass transit, except for the idea that's being offered now.
Basically, I don't think it had anything to do with not supporting regional transit. It had not supporting that particular plan.
Mark Brush tells us about a group that helps people with hoarding disorder.
They now know there's somebody they can touch base with, and that makes a huge difference in their world.
A filmmaker from Ann Arbor is up for an Academy Award for a documentary on a couple who got married in their 90s.
It turns really tough and devastating when what they want is not being honored and, you know, in some ways they're not even being treated as human beings.
And in honor of Black History Month, we'll hear about America's first celebrity bartender.
Cheers to Cato and to all the African-American bartenders working hard then and now.
Plus, we'll hear about a renewable energy company and the congressman who wants to end a program helping it. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, a Michigan congressman stops by to explain why he thinks changing how utility companies get renewable energy is good for Michigan. We'll also hear a response from someone in the renewable energy who disagrees. Plus, we'll get a preview of a new Michigan podcast called Mismatch, which focuses on incompatibility and airs next week here on Michigan Radio. But first, earlier this week, I spoke to Wayne County Executive Warren Evans and Washtenaw County Board Chair Andy LaBar about their counties considering a transit plan, which includes links from Ann Arbor to downtown Detroit. That's after it appeared Macomb and Oakland County leaders were distancing themselves from supporting a ballot proposal for a four-county regional transit system. Mark Hackle is the Macomb County executive, and he joins us now. Is Macomb County taking a pass on supporting a Detroit Metro transit plan?
I don't think Macomb County has ever taken a pass on not supporting a regional transit plan. In fact, I think Macomb County, if I'm not mistaken, is the only one that when the first original transit plan came together, that being SMART, was all in. If I'm not mistaken, I think Detroit was an opt-out by legislation. I don't think Washtenaw County was anywhere in the conversations, and Oakland County has many opt-out communities, as well as Wayne County outside of the city of Detroit. So Macomb County has always supported regional transit. Not only have they supported it from the onset, anytime there's been a millage renewal or a millage increase, Macomb County has always supported that. So when people say Macomb County doesn't support regional transit or regional transit, that's absolutely disingenuous as a statement.
Well, let me ask you then, are you willing to support and back and encourage people to vote for a ballot initiative, a tax raise for a more expanded regional transit?
But I think if there's a plan that makes sense for the voters in Macomb County, they would be willing to do that. But 26 out of 27 communities in Macomb County voted no on the original plan that came forward. And when that original plan came forward, there was a lot of complexities and a lot of unanswered questions that they had no interest in. So the county that once that continues to be 27 out of 27 supporting our regional transit provider, now saying 26 out of 27 saying no to that new plan, basically, I don't think it had anything to do with not supporting regional transit. It had not supporting that particular plan because they didn't believe it added value to Macomb County residents.
It's been suggested that now having a more complex regional transit system was a factor in Amazon passing on the Detroit area, not including it on a short list of options for a second headquarter. How important do you think mass transit is for economic development in the region?
Well, I don't think that's being honest. I don't think we're being honest with ourselves if that's what we're using as the excuse as to, you know, why Amazon didn't come here. Macomb County, we have...
Well, I did say it was the reason. I said it was a factor.
Well, I don't think that's... I don't think anybody has ever been able to substantiate that. I don't think that came from Amazon. Somebody explain to me where that came from outside of those that put a plan together to try to encourage Amazon to come here. Amazon came to Macomb County just recently. In fact, they're building a million-square-foot facility, adding another 1,000 jobs, and had nothing to do with transit, had everything to do with this being a location they found of interest for their business model.
Macomb County Commissioner Leon Drollet is arguing instead of transit, the county should be putting its money into roads. What's your position on his proposal?
It's not his proposal. My concern has always been, I think we need to get back to the fundamentals. The real issue I think that is facing us in Southeast Michigan is this road problem. It's the number one concern on everybody's conversation right now. And I hear about it and have been hearing about it for the last 7 years. And it's deteriorating to a point where we're getting further and further behind. So the number one concern for folks right now is, without question, fix roads first. And so, you know, the thought of adding money to other projects or other proposals or other interests, yeah, there's many out there. But the number one interest from residents in Macomb County is fix roads first. And we're not getting the response that's necessary out of Lansing.
I want to ask you about something that's been said about a statement you may or may not made. Did you suggest that car services such as Uber or Lyft or even driverless cars could be used instead of mass transit?
No, what I said is we've got connected vehicle opportunities here in Macomb County, and when we start moving forward with plans, we need to use our current provider to help us make a determination as to what resources might be out there or where we headed. I've been talking to the OEMs in the big three and their suppliers, and they're talking about, you know, transportation into the future. Here in Macomb County, we have infrastructure in play where they're actually testing connected vehicles and autonomous vehicles out on our roadways. And so with that being said, you know, our OEMs are thinking there's a far better opportunity moving forward with transportation of the masses than just whatever that RTA plan was that they're trying to put forward right now. Why aren't we looking into the future? And if it means looking or incorporating other service providers that might be out there from the private sector, that needs to be looked at and make a determination. Could this provide more efficiencies in moving people around that need support for transportation?
Is that more cost effective than mass transit for Macomb residents?
I don't know that it's ever been looked at. I don't think it's ever been assessed or even added into the conversation. So how would one know unless they're going to do an assessment of it or make that determination?
What do you think of the idea of Detroit, Wayne, and Washtenaw going ahead with a scaled-down transit plan, leaving Macomb and Oakland out of the plan?
Well, I think Oakland, Wayne, and Macomb have already done things regionally where Washtenaw County had not wanted to participate. They don't participate in the regional asset that I think they benefit from. That being, you know, the Detroit Zoo, the Detroit Institute of Arts, the COBO Authority. So Macomb, Wayne, and Oakland have always been involved in regional initiatives. In fact, we've always supported them. Macomb County has always supported every regional initiative that's come forward, and even the Great Lakes Water Authority, one that we were kind of forced into some mediation because of the bankruptcy, but yet we were able to work out some kind of an arrangement. So there hasn't been one regional initiative that Macomb County hasn't been supportive of, yet you know, we can't really see that from the others. I say that because I'll just go back to what your original conversation was, and that's about regional transit. Macomb County is the only county that supported the initial regional transit plan and still does to this day to the full extent. No other county or other community does. And the largest city in the entire region opted out by creating their own transit authority, that being DDOT.
Let's put this RTA plan aside for a second. What do you think the solution to mass transit in the region is?
There's no question. I said it before, even when I was on the dais, the big four, they called it at the time, myself, Dave Ding, and I think it was Bob Vacano and Brooks Patterson 7 years ago at COBO. My statement was, why aren't we building on the support of what we currently have? Why aren't we bringing them together to try to build on it incrementally and try to make a determination as we sell it to the public, you know, what these interests are, rather than one mass plan where people start to wonder, wait a minute, we're paying for rail, we're paying for, you know, some kind of a trolley down in the city of Detroit. Why is that of a benefit to us, and why can't that be a private sector development? So a lot of unanswered questions from the public that became very suspect, really, I think if we migrated to something on a continuous basis, would be more palatable. And I say that because incrementally we have already done that with new routes, adding different type of bus services for SMART, and when pitched to the public, they saw the need and they supported it. So I think instead of continuing to try to force something, I think as we continue to try to grow something, it makes more sense, and the public becomes a little bit more understanding of it and supportive of it. So we've got some good systems in place right now, and I find it, again, disingenuous when people say we have the worst transit system in the entire country when we've really never given a chance to try to figure out how do we merge, how do we grow together, and how do we support what we currently have. And SMART has always been an incredibly good supporter or provider of those of us, in particular Macomb County. And I say that because you know, they justify that when it comes to ballot proposals in support of the public.
Mark Hackle is the county executive of Macomb County. Thanks for taking the time.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
As I said earlier, we discussed the future of public transit in Southeast Michigan with Wayne County Executive Warren Evans and Washtenaw County Board Member or Board Chair Andy LaBarre on Wednesday's show. You can find that interview at the stateside page at michiganradio.org. L. Brooks Patterson, the Oakland County Executive, declined our invitation to share his perspective.
And now, a minute with Mike.
Perhaps it's already spread to your corner of Michigan. You know what I'm talking about, those aggravating, irritating, nauseating, and much repeated political advertisements. Yep, it's another election year. And with five people on the U.S. Supreme Court declaring a stack of cold, hard cash is not money, but rather free speech, well, my fellow Michiganers, we are about to get an earful and eyeful for the duration of 2018. Now, as much as we might collectively hate political ads, commercial TV and radio stations and now websites, they love it. It's the equivalent of the Christmas season, with the role of Santa Claus being played by political action committees. So, I've come up with a solution for candidates to save money and voter aggravation by not buying advertisements. It's the power of name recognition. And if you think having a good last name doesn't mean anything, just ask every judge with an Irish-sounding last name who no one really knows and yet is continually re-elected. Hey-o! So here is the solution. Are you ready, candidates? Change your last name to the state, county, city, village, township, or region you are attempting to represent. For example, if I was running for governor, I would simply change my last name to Michigan. Then I could say with some truthiness, vote Mike Michigan. A vote for my opponent is a vote against Michigan. And this technique works for most offices, mayors in particular. A candidate with a name, say, Alpena, would certainly win in Alpena. Likewise, Barry Badaxe, Oprah Owosso, Kelly Mazu, Winona Wyoming, and Ethel Ecorse would stand a good chance of winning in their respective cities. Now, this practice could even be applied to specific offices. I'd be willing to bet a couple of taxpayer-funded sports venues that a seat on the State Board of Education could be won if a candidate changed their name to Eddie-cation. So to sum it up, dear candidates, save your potential constituents the nearly year-long agony of being bombarded by political ads, and save your money. All you have to do is change your name, and you could win. Covering the Funny Bone Beat for Stateside, I'm Mike Blank.
When I covered Ronald Reagan's hometown of Dixon, the mayor's name was James Dixon. After the break, Michigan Radio's Mark Brush reports on how Washtenaw County was ahead of the game in helping hoarders, and we'll speak with a Michigander who has been nominated for an Oscar. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. For a while, this show was popular on cable.
Right now I have about 15 dogs and 9 cats.
I can't open it!
I'm horrified.
I'm gonna have to call somebody to pull you out of there!
I don't think I'm a hoarder.
Hoarders, a show about people who just can't stop hoarding things in their homes. Bathrooms, kitchens, living rooms are piled high with paper, dishes, clothes, food, doors can't open. Sometimes there are too many animals in the house. People with hoarding disorder put themselves, and sometimes others, in danger. The TV show resolves the issue with a lot of drama and tears, and the problem, at least what the viewer sees, is all taken care of in one or two episodes. But life doesn't work that way. And for a long time, there just wasn't a lot of help available for people with hoarding disorder. As part of our ongoing Minding Michigan series, Michigan Radio's Mark Brush tells us about a group in Washtenaw County that was one of the first in the country to help hoarders.
Dave French is built like a football player. He's quick with a laugh. He just spent about 45 minutes helping a woman sort through papers, magazines, and clothes. She struggles with depression, and her landlord has been on her to clear the clutter. French says when he first met her, things were a lot worse.
The door couldn't open. We couldn't walk at all through here. We couldn't go this way.
French works with a group called the Washtenaw County Hoarding Task Force. As he leaves the woman's apartment, he calls out a few reminders to her.
Just clear out the papers, throw them in a box, and you got your doors.
He helps all kinds of people. Some are down on their luck. Some are quite wealthy. He's helped people find expensive jewelry they've misplaced. He even helped one woman discover an account full of cash she didn't know about.
Pat, did you realize you have $500,000? Oh, great. Now about that old coffee maker, we gotta make sure...
French says he feels like he can give people a little bit of reassurance. that someone is on their side when it feels like no one is on their side.
Hi, I'm Lori.
Lori Latumsky is a social worker. She helped start the task force more than a decade ago. She's here visiting a new client at her apartment. The client wants to go by her initials, so we'll call her R.S. She's worried revealing her hoarding issues could affect her job. When we walk in, there are boxes and stacks of things everywhere.
I'm a rubber stamper, so a lot of this stuff is rubber stamping stuff, mm-hmm. making cards and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. R.S. says she's been getting letters from her landlord. Letters saying she needs to clean up the piles of stuff in her kitchen. There are piles of paper covering the kitchen counters and the stove. A friend insisted she call the task force.
So basically you want help with the kitchen, or you want somebody who can then help you with other areas as well?
That'd be helpful to have
somebody help you
organization with my stamp stuff.
Okay.
Latumsky says she'll have a volunteer come in to help. And then RS will make piles of things to keep, recycle, or throw away.
The volunteer then would take everything that would go to donation
okay.
or to trash with them when they left.
Oh, wow.
So you'd only have the keep stuff left.
Wow.
Okay? And then...
It's just amazing.
Well, they do that so that, you know, you don't have those second thoughts mm-hmm. and kind of worry about it and think about it.
RS says her sister has been helping her cut down on clutter.
Well, and you guys should get to be sisters. Not just do this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Right, when you have time, you should right. be able to do sister stuff.
Right.
Latumsky writes down some information and tells RS she'll call her to set up an appointment. RS says she didn't think she'd be able to find help like this.
I was so surprised. I was just like, wow, help I need.
Thank you, lady.
Thank you.
You hang in there.
Okay. Bye-bye.
We get in the car and head out. Latumsky says RS's situation is pretty typical. No major safety issues, no mold or mildew. She has pathways to all her doors and windows. She just has a lot of stuff.
And people with hoarding disorder aren't disabled and they're not stupid. Right? You know, they read magazines, they watch TV, they know this is not the standard. But for some reason, they're comfortable there. For whatever reason that is. I mean, they frankly don't know that I don't go home and crawl in my window.
She says people have many different reasons that drive them to hoard. It can be mental illness or trauma or an emotional connection to stuff they inherited from a family member. Latumsky says so far they've helped 237 people with hoarding disorder. And the Washtenaw County Task Force has inspired other cities and counties in Michigan. Grand Rapids has a task force up and running now. And other cities and counties are trying to start them. Latumsky says it's not always smooth. Progress can be slow and frustrating. Sometimes they discover disturbing things like dead animals. And sometimes people lose their motivation to change. But Latumsky says she gets so much more back than she gives.
And a lot of these folks don't have family and other people. And they don't fit the mental health system or they don't fit the senior population. But they now know there's somebody they can touch base with. And that makes a huge difference in their world. And frankly, ours too.
She says the task force can make people safer in their own homes and give them some of their power back. For Stateside, I'm Mark Brush.
Laura Checkaway has just finished a film that is now being nominated for an Oscar. She's the director, producer, and editor of a film called Edith and Eddie. It's up for Best Documentary Short Film. She is from Ann Arbor, and she joins us now. I got to tell you, I watched this half-hour documentary, and I was delighted. I was disturbed. I was angry, and walking away, the only term I could think of was, that was heart-wrenching. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks for watching it, and thanks for having me on.
How did you meet Edith and Eddie?
A friend texted a photo of them to me that was circulating online after they'd gotten married. They were being called America's oldest interracial newlyweds. So she sent me the photo, and I just was so touched looking at it. I kept zooming in and looking into their eyes, and I just wanted to know more about them. So I connected the dots, and their family invited me down. Within a few days, I was on a bus from New York City to Virginia to meet them.
Let's listen to a clip from the movie. This is Eddie.
What did I love about Edith? Well, she was kind and considerate in talking to me. Not the color of the skin, but the heart. That's what we decided. Well, the heart is red, I believe.
So Edith and Eddie got married at ages 95 and 96. They both say it was love at first sight. Really beautiful couple. Tell me a little bit about what you found when you first got there.
It was really special to see them together. They were always holding hands. They went out dancing. They were active in their church community. Actually, the first time that I met them is the opening scene of the film where we see them dancing together. And it was just really special to be in their presence. They were so proud of their love. And everywhere we went, Edith would just get giddy when she introduced her new husband to people. So it felt really, really special.
How did they meet?
They met while outside of a store where they were playing the numbers, and they, you know, met over a lottery ticket.
And he was using her numbers, I take it.
He was playing the numbers, and as he tells it in the film, he just kept playing it and playing it, and eventually he won, and then they split the earnings.
So they got married, they had a house, but there was a family dispute. The daughters of Edith, sisters who disagreed about what should happen to them and whether they should be married and living together and all these things. What did that end up resulting in?
So Edith's daughters don't agree on what's best for their mom, and it winds up in court, and Edith's rights wind up being put in the hands of a legal guardian who's appointed by the court, whom she has not met. And the couple's marriage is in danger of being torn apart.
So we're going to leave it there. I want to talk about some of the challenges you had in filming this. I mean, you were rushed. You had to get down there. You had to basically be like glue to them. What was the hardest part of that?
You know, it was just really tough to see what they were going through and what I had hoped would be an inspiring story. I mean, it is an inspiring story because we do witness the power of love, and that they are at least looking to live on their own terms. And it turns really tough and devastating when what they want is not being honored. And, you know, in some ways, they're not even being treated as human beings.
That's the thing that kept going through my mind over and over again. I kept thinking the word ageism. These people had their faculties, although there were questions about Edith's. I didn't see any evidence of dementia, but they claimed that in the film. But they seemed just fine, and yet they couldn't even have control of their own life, and they were so in love.
Yeah, and you know, we all need help with certain things, and as we get older, sometimes we need help in certain areas. It doesn't mean that we're not clear about what we want in other areas. And so it felt clear that she and Eddie wanted to be together, and it was just really tough.
You've made other award-winning films. How does it feel to be nominated for an Academy Award?
Absolutely incredible. You know, especially the way that this film was made, it was made independently and just very bare bones with a really small, devoted team of people. So to have it received in this light is incredibly special. And because this couple was so dishonored towards the end of their lives, you know, I just feel like it means that much more. And it's just a true testament to them. I also would love to add that what we witness happen with Edith and Eddie is actually happening to elders all over the country, and it's alarming. So we really, really hope that the film can wake people up and make an impact.
That is Laura Checkaway. She's the director, producer, and editor of the film Edith and Eddie. It's up for an Oscar for Best Documentary Short Film. Thanks very much for sharing their story.
Thank you so much.
Laura Checkaway joined us via Skype. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Things don't always fit together neatly. Life would be really boring if they did. That's the driving idea behind a new podcast called Mismatch: Stories of the Incompatible, the Unsuitable, the Out of Step. It's written and hosted by Roger Weber. As many of you might remember, Weber was a reporter on WDIV-TV for 37 years before retiring in 2015. Here's stateside Cynthia Candy speaking with her old friend.
Full disclosure, folks, I had the pleasure of getting to know Roger through the years as we were rolling around in our TV news trucks covering the same stories for competing TV stations. Pleasure to say, Roger Weber, welcome to the airwaves of Michigan Radio.
Oh, Cindy, it is great to be with you. And yep, we had some good times out there.
Some good, some will say interesting. How's that?
Yes, that's the diplomatic word for it. There were some stories that I would rather not be reassigned to.
I'm with you there. Well, tell me how and when you came up with the idea of this podcast Mismatch.
Well, it actually was the station, WDIV, and the parent company, Graham Media, that approached me to do this last summer. And obviously, you've got to have a title for this. And they know about my love for storytelling and things that are kind of off the beaten trail. And it occurred to me that often things don't line up, people to people, people with their circumstances. And I thought Mismatch would be a rather catchy way to do it. One of the mismatches is the time Sparky Anderson interviewed Richard Nixon. Now, that's not a mismatch. I've never heard of anything.
You know, well, you were known during your TV reporting years, Roger Weber, for features. I know you won an Edward R. Murrow Award, for instance, for your story about a couple celebrating their 70th wedding anniversary. Terrific stories about World War II veterans, about the Great Lakes Military Cemetery in northern Oakland County. All of that much, much different than the bread and butter of TV news, the fires and the murders and the tragedies. And so this is your chance.
Oh, yeah. And to the station's credit, even though I had to cover the hard news, and that's kind of the bread and butter of what we do, they let me do these other stories from time to time. And I tell you, that really kept me going. When you're in the final years of a 37-year career at that station, you need those things to kind of refuel your jets. And so I give them credit for doing it. But even then, you can't begin to cover the kinds of stories I'm doing on Mismatch in a television news format. You've got to worry about the cameras. You've got to worry about the time. 4 minutes tops. That's a very long story for television. And now I can go 25, 30 minutes, and I can let the story breathe and have a little music and go off on a few tangents. And it's just a fun way to tell a story.
Yeah, Vic, talk to us some more, Roger, about the differences that you're finding in working in this medium of podcasting versus the years in the news truck with your videographer trying to make your slot for the 6 p.m. Live shot.
Well, I don't have to talk in the cold.
No silly hats, right?
Try to say Roger Weber when it's 10 below zero.
Yeah.
So I'm not wearing a tie, and I have my own recording equipment, and I have a great producer, Zach Rosen, and he records things too. And we go back and forth and collaborate on the scripts. It's a liberating feeling not to have to match video with everything I write. That's a big difference, and to have that extra time to let the story go.
And I think that is something that people don't realize as they're watching that newscast, that if that typical story, you might get 60 seconds, maybe 75 seconds to tell everything. And it is very liberating to feel like you've done the story justice.
Yeah, the logistics of television news can be very complicated, exasperating. You've got to get to different places. You've got to get that video turned. We were often doing, usually doing two stories a day. So right out of the gate, you have that deadline over your head. And I'm also not working on such an oppressive deadline. I've got a little time to work on these and get them just right.
Well, what do you hope that the people who listen to Mismatch will take away from these stories that you're telling, Roger?
I don't think I'm trying to give them any profound messages. I just want to take them on some adventures. And I've always believed that just regular folks have the best stories to tell. I'm not really intrigued by interviewing politicians and athletes and celebrities, which I would occasionally do, as much as I am interviewing regular folk and just seeing what they have been through, the adventures that they tell. And you'll find people like that in your own family, I'll bet you, if you really think of what they have done. So I like telling those stories.
That was Roger Weber, host of Mismatch, speaking with Cynthia Canty. Next week, Mismatch will take us back to 1928 when Henry Ford established Fordlandia. It was a spectacular failure. Plus a Romeo and Juliet tale involving the heir to the Dodge Motor Company. Listen for Mismatch next Monday and Tuesday at 3 o'clock each day and again at 10 in the evening on Michigan Radio. Still to come, there's a possible change coming that might let Michigan big utility companies off the hook when it comes to buying renewable energy. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Consumers Energy wants to stop buying renewable energy from outside sources. Under the 1978 Federal Public Utilities Regulator Policy Act, which we'll call PURPA, state regulators can encourage more renewable energy by requiring utilities to purchase electricity generated by solar, wind, biomass, or other renewable resources at the same rate that it would cost the utility to make it. That helps Michigan to be less dependent on fossil fuels and supports development of renewable energy sources. Consumers Energy is asking the Michigan Public Service Commission to let the company off the hook. At the same time, Congressman Tim Walberg has introduced legislation to change PURPA in a way that would let big utilities decline to buy green energy. Consumers Energy likes that a lot. Joining us now is Kevin Borgia, Midwest Policy Director for Cypress Creek Renewables. That's one of the green energy companies which sells green energy to Consumers Energy under PURPA. Now, first, tell us a little bit about your company. Are you solar, wind?
So Cypress Creek Renewables is one of the largest independent generators of solar energy in the country. We have well over 1,300 megawatts of operating solar assets in the country, which is enough to power in the neighborhood of millions of homes. The focus that we have on Michigan is that we think that there is a real economic incentive to build solar in the state, and we think that that is going to be a very beneficial thing from an economic standpoint for ratepayers, but also from the benefit of creating jobs and, of course, creating emissions-free clean energy in the state of Michigan is going to be a benefit both economically and environmentally.
What happens to your company if Consumers Energy is allowed to decline buying electricity from sources like Cypress Creek, whether by permission of the state regulators or by a change in the federal law PURPA?
Sure. We think that if those actions were to move forward, we think that we would really just not be able to invest in Michigan to the degree that we want to. And that business opportunity would end up depriving Michiganders of those jobs and those economic opportunities, would deprive those farmers who are interested in leasing their land and providing some protection against those falling commodity prices that can really hamper farmers' ability to keep farming the land. And so if the proposals were to move forward as Consumers has recommended, we think that that would really deprive us of a business opportunity, but also would deprive Michigan of a great economic opportunity.
Now, Consumers Energy says PURPA means higher power bills. If the company is buying green energy from you at the same price as it costs consumers to generate it, how does that translate to higher bills?
You're asking the right questions there. I mean, PURPA is about keeping rates low. I mean, the letter of the law specifically states that if a private developer can generate power at a rate that's competitive with the utility's cost to generate it, they have to buy your power. And it's something that is about protecting ratepayers. It's not about higher costs. It's quite the opposite.
I do know Consumers has talked about they can get it cheaper off the free market, but the free market price really fluctuates a lot, especially if there's peak demand. So I'm not sure what they're talking about there. Let me ask you something else, though. Alternative energy such as solar is getting cheaper and cheaper to build. I mean, even with these solar tariffs that the president wants, solar's going to continue to drop in price. It would seem that, if anything, green energy is going to be cheaper in the future. So I don't understand why consumer energy – I don't understand the motivation for consumers' energy to get out, especially since it's planning to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80% in the next 20 years. What insight do you have into what's going on here?
Well, I think consumers have stated publicly that low energy prices and renewable energy can certainly coexist. I mean, they're publicly stating this in a variety of different venues, and we certainly agree. We think that the trend for solar costs is very much moving in a downward direction. The costs have come down for solar generation, something like, I believe it's over 60% in the past 5 to 7 years. So we've seen these enormous cost declines. And if you look at the cost decline that solar has, the broader trend of solar costs since, say, 1980, I mean, we have come down just factors of magnitude from where we were a couple of decades ago. And we think that that trend is going to continue, whereas for fossil fuel sources, the trend is more upward. You know, natural gas prices are very low right now. That's certainly true. But there's not much room for them to go, nowhere for them to really go but up. And so solar, currently at its low price and increasingly lower price, can really tie ratepayers to low pricing that can be locked in for several years. One of the benefits of solar and other renewable generation is that we don't have a fuel. And so once the project is built and you've capitalized the asset, you're able to operate that facility at very, very low cost for decades. And so we can offer low fixed price energy contracts for upwards of 20 years. And that's just something that no fossil fuel resource can really give. And so we think that the ratepayer benefit of having those locked in low rates is something that the Public Service Commission and Michigan regulators and our members of Congress as well should recognize.
If you could talk to Representative Tim Walberg, what would you tell him about his plan to essentially end PURPA's green energy incentives?
Yeah, we think in general, Representative Walberg's bill seeks to move backward away from competitive energy markets. Again, PURPA is all about allowing private enterprise to find ways to compete with the existing polluting energy sources. And without the opportunity for private companies to move forward with businesses in Michigan and in other states, we'll have a hindering of technological innovation. And so, you know, while there are certainly, it's certainly reasonable to do a refresh of you know, legislation every now and then, and there may be some aspects of PURPA that do warrant some changes.
Right. It's been around since 78.
Correct. Right. I mean, but the approach that he's taken would move in the wrong direction. It would move more in the direction of monopoly utilities, less competition. And we think that's bad for the private sector, but also for ratepayers across the country.
Kevin Borgia is Midwest Policy Director for Cypress Creek Renewables. Thanks for talking to us about this.
Thanks, Lester.
As we noted, Michigan's 7th District Congressman Tim Walberg is proposing changes to that Public Utilities Regulatory Policies Act. He joins us now. As it's currently written, PURPA opened up renewable energy at a scale that might not have been possible otherwise. Why do you want to change that?
Yeah, I certainly give that to you. I think PURPA had a very positive impact 40 years ago and even on up to the present. Back when it was introduced, renewable energies were really in an infancy as far as their acceptance and the pushing to get them up and running, and then to find out how good they could be. And over time, we've seen the cost of renewables go down. We've seen the variety and scope, some of the competition even that's been there in renewables. But it's a 40-year-old law, and we want to make sure that the ratepayers, the consumers, still have the best deal, as well as having advancements in the creation and generation of energy. And so that's why it's our effort to take a look at that 40-year-old law and try to bring it up to the present, and all the while still promoting quality energy using an all-of-the-above plan, which includes renewables.
If the utilities are paying the same price for green energy as it costs the big power companies to generate electricity, sometimes even less, how's that causing higher electricity bills?
Well, right now, we're finding out that because of the increase in electricity and generation of electricity out there, and the fact that, frankly, PURPA helped push the utilities, the major utilities, into doing what they are doing now, and that is using renewables and doing it on their own as well. And all we're saying is let's keep the competition going. Let's make sure that the consumers are only paying for what they need and not at a higher cost. When we find out that there are some certainly some gaming going on with, for instance, the one-mile rule.
I'm not sure what that is, the one-mile rule.
Well, in PURPA, the original law, there's a one-mile rule that says anything outside of that is usable for purchase from utilities if they're inside of that and they're all in the same, for instance, the same company producing that, and they have several generation sites, but they're within the one-mile radius, then they don't count. If they're just outside of it or beyond, then they can be counted in. So we're finding some of the renewables, I'm not going to get into giving names, but some of the renewables that are gaming the system using the law as written, not as intended, and ultimately making more companies that our utilities have to buy from based upon the law. So that's something we have to change, but we're finding that in the case of ratepayers, very easily, we're seeing in certain cases that they're paying 30% to 50% higher costs for the generation of the renewable energy that the utility has to purchase than they would buying from that same utility with their own renewable energy sources.
But that's not what PURPA says. It says that they buy this green energy as long as it costs no more than it would cost the utility to generate its own electricity.
But the how they figure it ends up that it ultimately is gamed by the providers in the system. If you didn't have all of those in the system, it would actually be a lessened cost. And that's, again, the reason why we've offered this legislation to start us talking about what is out there, what's needed, and what can be done better, as opposed to keeping a 40-year law in place that it actually ends up discouraging, in certain cases, the development of energy resources that are renewable.
As you know, we talked to Cypress Creek Renewables just before we talked to you. They're concerned about, you know, losing a lot of revenue. They're concerned about jobs. They wanted to expand in Michigan, that particular company, and they're not sure they're going to be able to if PURPA changes. So what about the jobs that renewable energy companies have created? Won't this elimination of PURPA's green energy incentives mean jobs lost?
No, I don't think so. It may not be Cypress or some other company supplying it, but the jobs will be there. But again, the key issue is to make sure that while we want to see jobs come into our state, even from out of state, if they want to invest in Michigan, we want to make sure that the ratepayers of Michigan, in my case the 7th District, pay no more than they should have to pay for their energy. And that's the only concern that we have with using some outdated rules and laws without even talking about how can we change it. Now, again, in our bill, if you've read it, it gives a great amount of latitude for our state public service commission to make some provisions and make decisions on their own for the best interest of, one, jobs in our state, the energy-providing sources, the competition, but most importantly, the consumers. So there is some latitude here, and Cypress, they ought to be a competitor. They ought to have the opportunity to compete, but they certainly ought to have only the opportunity to compete when it's a fair system for Michigan's consumers.
Part of PURPA's purpose was to reduce the nation's reliance on fossil fuels. If that's a national goal, how is eliminating this aspect of PURPA helping?
Well, I don't think it eliminates the national goal for diminishing the use on fossil fuels, if that's the best way. It doesn't do that at all. I mean, we're not changing the fact that we're still pushing the standards, and Michigan has significantly pushed the standards for upgrading the percentage of renewable fuel sources that are out there and the generation of energy that comes from renewables. That doesn't change at all. And what we're doing, very clearly, we're not attempting to move backwards. We're saying the times have changed, the renewables have advanced, and PURPA is one of the major reasons for it. But PURPA, in 1978, had a different landscape to deal with than they have now. And I think PURPA did one thing, and that pushed maybe a stodgy utility entity that has been out there all across the United States, kind of a one-size-fits-all, and we're going to just keep using the fossil fuels. We're going to keep using coal, if that's the case. We may move to natural gas, but renewables, that's not our thing. green energy isn't where we're going. We've seen because of this law and because of some of the success of renewables and the cost going down for renewables that now the utilities, in fact, are leading the way in certain cases on promoting renewable energy. So, no, I don't think it goes backwards at all. It keeps us right where we're at and moves forward and attempts to upgrade. Again, the thing we want to do is start a firm discussion. We've had two hearings already in Congress. I'm sure we'll have more. We're having discussions with entities, whether it be Cypress or DTE or Consumers Energy or you name it. We're having discussions now on how do we move forward for the best benefit of the consumer. And ultimately, I think that's what we in government ought to be concerned with. And I would hope the industry would as well be pushed into competing to provide the safest, most secure, cleanest, and longest-lasting energy for our consumers at the best cost.
That was Republican Congressman Tim Walberg talking about his proposed changes to PURPA, the Federal Public Utilities Regulatory Policy Act.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings, and you've got a cocktail for us on Cheers. Imagine that.
Shocking, I know. So we're coming up to the end of Black History Month, and I wanted to make sure that we gave a shout out to some of the amazing black bartenders who have worked in the past and the present. And so today I've got a Gin Daisy, and this comes courtesy of the first celebrity bartender in America, who was an African-American named Cato Alexander.
We heard about him from our talk with Amas Muhammad last year.
That's right. But last year we made one of Amas's own drinks, so this year I wanted to give Cato a moment in the spotlight.
So this is his drink, the Gin Daisy.
We don't know if he invented it or if it was just a drink of the time, but it was definitely the sort of thing that people would be drinking when they went to Cato's house, which was his bar that he opened in 1810 outside New York City.
It's nice that we have that history. What's the drink like?
So it's got 2 ounces of gin, an ounce of grenadine, and I really recommend using your own homemade grenadine for this.
Actually, we've got a recipe. We'll link to it when we put this online.
Great. Half an ounce of lime juice. So I combine those in a shaker, shake them up with some ice, and then strain them into a Collins glass or a highball glass. Top it off with 2 ounces of club soda and some ice to fill up the glass. And it's an easy drinking, delicious cocktail.
What kind of gin did you use?
I used the Railroad Gin from Detroit City Distillery today.
Why that one?
Honestly, so you know how some people buy their wines by the label? You know, they want the one with the funny animal on it.
Mm-hmm.
I just really like the label on this gin. It has a really classic old kind of feel to it and sort of made me think of history and Cato Alexander.
All right. When a cocktail instructor starts buying gin by the label, I guess we're all safe, right?
And I know it's a delicious gin, right?
So this is the Gin Daisy. I'm going to take a little sip.
So just to, while you sip on that, tell you a little bit more about Cato Alexander. So he was actually born a slave, but gained his freedom at age 19 through New York's passing of the Act for the General Abolition of Slavery. And that sort of led the way to him eventually opening up his own place, which attracted a huge amount of attention. People would travel from near and far, especially seeking out the drinks and the food. His curried oysters were really famous, and cocktails like this Gin Daisy.
This Gin Daisy doesn't taste like it has alcohol in it at all to me. It's refreshing, it's light, it's really tasty. That grenadine really shines, but that could be dangerous. You should make sure you limit yourself ahead of time.
Right, or just remember this in the summer when you need a porch drink. This is totally a porch drink.
So that's the Gin Daisy from Cato's house. We found a drawing of Cato's house that we'll put online as well, but we couldn't find a picture of Cato. That's too bad, actually.
Cheers to Cato and to all the African-American bartenders working hard then and now.
I'll drink to that.
Cheers.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Rusty Brock, who said, "I sort of did okay today." Folks, that's about as good as it gets, I suppose. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.